From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As America observed the anniversary of 9/11, the rest of the world did too. A satellite TV news service called WorldLink offers thorough, uncut broadcasts of the news elsewhere, and its Middle East service, called Mosaic, followed the coverage there. Mosaic producer Jamal Dejani, a Palestinian-American, said that in some ways the anniversary observances throughout the region were radically different from our own, but in other ways they were very much the same.
It was very graphic. Almost every station played the same stuff that was played on American television. Dedication, the Ground Zero, the destruction, President Bush's speech. But at the same time, they had different stories. Stories, for example, about the effects of 9/11 on the Arab American communities and the Muslim communities in the United States.
Let's begin with some of those, the stories we wouldn't have heard here.
For example, from Al Manar Television, which is the voice of the Shiite Muslims from Lebanon, and it's financed by Iran, they basically wanted to highlight the discrimination, the pain of the Muslim and Arab communities in the United States. But on the other hand, other stations, for example, Future Television from Lebanon, they featured a Palestinian-American story. He's an attorney. And how the events of September 11 has changed his life, how it made him feel more American than Palestinian, how his definition of terrorism has changed.
With regard to Iraqi state TV, I think we can pretty much predict how they would react to the events.
Iraqi state television had an interesting story. They were talking about the usual that the United States is going to use the September 11th as a pretext to invade Iraq, but they also criticized American media for making such a big production out of it to bring fear to the American public.
And the Israel Broadcast Authority?
Israel Broadcast Authority, on the other hand, their coverage is very Americanized. For one thing, they do not question who are the perpetrators. There is no doubt the guilty party is bin Laden.
But you didn't find that in either Jordan or in Egypt. These broadcasters tend usually to take a more moderate line. How did Jordan cover our 9/11 anniversary?
Jordan chose to cover a story about the conspiracy issue. There is a circulating story about the Arabs did not cause this, or it's not bin Laden, it's more sophisticated for any one individual to pull. So it must have been the work of the CIA or the Mossad. So they had an Algerian-French writer that wrote a book questioning whether a plane has struck the Pentagon or was it a missile?
Right. That book has been a big seller in France, and it suggests that this was some effort by the Bush administration itself to pump up the military budget by faking an attack.
This is a big hit. I mean, they're looking also for ratings like everyone else.
There were quotes in the Times from Egyptians who said, in America, a pigeon isn't even allowed to fly without government authorization. How could Egyptians possibly have commandeered a plane to do that? And I wonder, did Egyptian television echo the line of that person quoted in the Times? Did they echo this belief in the conspiracy theory?
Actually, our story did show that. From Nile Television, we had a story. Actually, it was a live interview with Dr. Zaghloul al-Najjar, and he was questioning the reasons for the attack. And he said, listen, how could you indict bin Laden? How could you come up with just a straightforward accusation? After all, JFK has been dead for so many years, and still Americans are questioning who committed that crime. So how could we just so quickly say, well, it is bin Laden?
What surprised you most about the Middle Eastern coverage on September 11th? What didn't you expect?
I wasn't expecting that they're going to produce, for example, Palestine TV stories showing the Palestinian children carrying banners saying no to terrorism, carrying banners saying that we sympathize with the victims of 9/11.
As you've reviewed the coverage for me now, it sounds as if It ranged all over the map. Was there anything that seemed to unite the reaction to the 9/11 anniversary that you could point to?
Yes, absolutely. The sympathy is very prevalent. But you have in the Middle East 22 different countries and about 280 million people. And each has a different opinion, a different position. But absolutely, I would say every country is not supportive of terrorism. They're as shocked as the American public are shocked here with these horrific events.
Jamal Dajani, thank you very much.
Thank you for talking to us.
Jamal Dajani is producer of Mosaic News from the Middle East on WorldLink TV. You can find it on satellite TV and at worldlinktv.com.
What do you do if you're a media outlet whose programming would generally have nothing to do with 9/11 on a day when that was all people cared about? If you're the Food Network or the off-track betting simulcast, you didn't break format. But other non-news outlets did address the anniversary in their own ways, and OTM's Mike Pesca was reading, watching, and listening.
Trashy television, its defenders point out, only got that way because people watch. TV, the producers of Fear Factor and Elimidate say, is democratic. Each media consumer has access to hundreds of channels, and oh yeah, millions of internet sites, dozens of radio stations, and in some towns, more than a couple newspapers. Like a multi-party parliamentary system, American media is in some ways more democratic than American government, and Nielsen boxes work better than Florida voting booths. But on days like Wednesday, the media gets a little less democratic than usual.
Wendy, if you will, tell us what's happening at Ground Zero today.
Well, Lee, ceremonies will be going on all day long, and they've been going on since the wee hours of this morning. It started with bagpipe players coming from all five boroughs in New York City.
That coverage of the ceremonies and issues surrounding the September 11th anniversary could have come from any number of networks, and it did. The Christian Broadcasting Network. Reverend Pat Robertson's 700 Club was one of many outlets to offer its own take.
We don't know what's in their evil mind, but believe you, they've been planning something for the last couple of years for now. So we need to pray. God can frustrate the plans of evil people.
The 700 Club broadcasts its mix of news and prayer on basic cable systems carried into tens of millions of homes. But it's the sort of outlet that's off the radar screens of the broadcasting establishment. Other sources of information aren't sources of news per se, but on days like 9/11, they're challenged to act like it. Some choose to stay true to their mission.
Everybody has to handle today in their own way. That's what they have to do. They have to handle it the way they feel comfortable. Let's go to Mary in Staten Island. Mary, you're next on 1050 ESPN Radio.
Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hi. I almost feel embarrassed to be asking a baseball question today. And
please don't.
Okay, but I really don't ever get a chance to call you. Do you think the Yankees are going to use a platoon at third base for the playoffs?
Absolutely not.
The 9/11 anniversary took on an elephant in the living room quality on ESPN Radio, but the opposite tack was taken on New York's WFAN, The Fan. Mike Francesa, who hosts the most listened-to sports program in the country, opened his show by explaining its temporary irrelevance.
It's always kind of tricky with The Fan, because some people always expect us to do sports no matter what happens, no matter what happens in the real world, no matter in what way the reality rears its ugly head. But there are certain days where it's just a little different. There are certain days when sports just kind of stand still, and today is one of those days.
For a few weeks after the attacks, WFAN transformed itself from sports talk to terrorism talk, using essentially the same mix of bold, if not fully informed, hosts and angry calls from listeners to occasionally achieve a real sense of electronic community. Talk radio could switch formats to accommodate the shifting world. But after 9/11/01, one part of the news media remained temporarily unaware. The funny pages, up through October, were still funny. Comic strips, which have to be submitted a month or so in advance, were literally, and for the first time figuratively, in suspended animation, blithely serving up gags and groans, unaware that the world had changed. Artist Chip Dunham draws a strip about pirates called Overboard. His anniversary strip had the pirates talking to Chip himself about the need to wax eloquent, But all they could muster was a moment of silence, staring into the darkness.
I said, do I want my character, you know, knocked overboard by a wave, or do I want to try to do something with my couple of seconds? So, I mean, to be honest, what profound things do I have to say? And maybe just bring a little silence to it.
Stefan Pastis draws the strip Pearls Before Swine. His strips have always ended in a gag, except the one that ran this Wednesday. His main character, Pig, writes a letter saying, "Dear God, please don't let any child ever lose a mom or dad again." Pig mails it and then waits for days by the mailbox, eventually falling asleep under the stars. Pastis says he's not going to turn Pearls Before Swine into something maudlin, but the occasion called for him to break his own rules.
If it's in you and you want to say something, then you should say it. I think if you're doing it out of a sense of obligation, then it's probably going to come across as not very sincere. I mean, people just sense that right away. So my angle on it, I think, was not the crying Statue of Liberty angle that a lot of people did. It's pretty different.
In some ways, the news media were obligated towards solemn coverage of the anniversary. The official ceremony strove to achieve it, and to be the only outlet with a different tone was to play the rebel in a day dedicated to unity. But solemnity wasn't reflective of the entire mood. MTV viewers could find reassurance in a special called Pop Life Goes On. The sports radio crowd vented. And while The Daily Show with Jon Stewart took the night off, all the other late-night shows joked at least a little. The most unusual anniversary broadcast was The Howard Stern Show, which replayed last year's coverage. At one point during the rebroadcast, Howard asks, "What's the point of staying on the air? Everyone must be watching the news by now." He was probably right. Even the website, which practically transcribes every moment of The Stern Show, tuned out that day. But as a time capsule, heard 1 year later, Stern presented something for his audience that was raw and real and frequently confused and jarringly different from the carefully constructed remembrances, and therefore pretty worthwhile. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, what is a weapon of mass destruction and why newspapers sometimes bury the big story?
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the nervous days after last year's 9/11 attacks, a chill went down the spine of the journalistic community when presidential spokesman Ari Fleischer cautioned critics to watch what they say. That remark, along with the administration's hardline approach to freedom of information requests, raised the specter of the war on terror being invoked to curb press freedoms. Elsewhere around the world, the threat is not merely in the air, it is in the jails. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that a number of authoritarian regimes are harassing and violently intimidating the press under the pretext of national security. Joel Simon is the deputy director of the CPJ. He joins us now. Joel, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, none of the countries that you mention in your report, Eritrea, Kazakhstan, Indonesia, are exactly models of press freedom to begin with. So how exactly have things changed in the past year?
What's changed is that the governments have adopted the rhetoric of the war on terrorism. Often, critical journalists are now described as terrorists, and some of the suppression of civil liberties, including press freedom, gets less attention internationally, which allows repressive governments sort of greater latitude and cover to carry out these policies.
Well, one example of what you mentioned would be Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, who has used all sorts of anti-terrorism rhetoric in suppressing his press. But on the other hand, it's equally true that Zimbabwe has been more in the public eye in the past year as Mugabe's suppression gets ever more draconian. Is it true that people are actually getting away with this in the dark as far as the public is concerned?
Well, each case is different. In Zimbabwe, you're absolutely right. But in other parts of the world, there is less attention. One example is Central Asia. With the U.S. presence, you would think that that would be an opportunity to raise these issues. That hasn't happened. Another country is Colombia. that's a country where the press is increasingly being caught on one side of this polarizing rhetoric. The government there is now calling the guerrillas terrorists and also pressuring journalists to take more of a government line. It's being more aggressive.
And what about the United States State Department? Is it active in trying to expose these abuses where they occur, or is it looking the other way, or what?
I would say, in our experience, we've brought abuses to the attention of the State Department and hope that they would speak out, and that's been increasingly difficult. Our sense, certainly, is that in making strategic alliances, often the primary consideration is the military importance of that alliance, and human rights and civil liberties and press freedom are not particularly high on the bilateral agenda.
Well, you could make the argument, and I think people have, in fact, that one of the reasons we're in this war on terrorism mess to begin with is because the United States has supported, indeed propped up, a whole lot of very repressive regimes that hold press freedom, among other things, in low esteem. If it's true that the United States is looking the other way because of strategic political considerations, aren't we just going to create exactly the kind of conditions that bred terrorism to begin with?
Not supporting press freedom in these countries is short-sighted because you undermine the ability of these countries to create the mechanisms that support democracy, and you implicitly legitimate these repressive governments that can polarize these societies further, and that could become a foreign policy headache for the U.S. in the long run.
There have been new restrictions put in place that make it harder for American journalists to get information about what the government is up to. And there's been a lot of crying about it, including on this show. I gather the problems domestic journalists face pale entirely next to the problems of journalists in countries where, for example, there's no judicial system to protect them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what's dangerous is the precedent that the U.S. government has established in its actions is being emulated around the world. And that precedent is certain civil liberties, including press freedom, may have to be compromised during times of conflict, that the government must extend secrecy, and that it's acceptable or understandable during conflict to keep the press away from the battlefield. For example, in Chechnya, where journalists who have, at grave personal risk to themselves, Russian journalists, covered the Chechen conflict and have pressured the Russian government to allow greater access. Well, that argument is much more difficult to make when the Russian government can point to the limited access that U.S. journalists had covering the conflict in Afghanistan.
Very well. Joel Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Simon is Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Every once in a while, we consider a word or a phrase that suddenly pops up and resounds through the media. This week, it's weapons of mass destruction, as in this usage by Vice President Dick Cheney.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use them against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
In the defense community, the phrase weapons of mass destruction generally refers to chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. But in a recent column for Slate.com, Timothy Noah argues that the term should be reserved for nukes. Tim Noah joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's look at weapons of mass destruction, that phrase, as a tool of political rhetoric. Go over how it's been used by members of the Bush administration.
It's been used, for example, by Vice President Dick Cheney. He said in a speech on August 26, the whole range of weapons of mass destruction would rest in the hands of a dictator who has already shown his willingness to use such weapons. And he said that after he'd made reference to chemical and biological weapons and to nuclear arms. He, I think, is deliberately conflating nuclear weapons and chemical and biological weapons in order to make the threat seem maximally terrible.
Now, Saddam does not have that weapon of mass destruction, nukes, as far as we know, yet.
Right. And I think that fact is blurred when Dick Cheney refers to Saddam as having weapons of mass destruction. It allows his listeners to conflate nuclear weapons with biological weapons. And I think we can all understand instinctively that it's a much more frightening idea that Saddam Hussein would have nuclear weapons.
And we can assume that the goal of Cheney in using language in this way is to gin up support for a war against Iraq.
That's right. It's a way of saying that he's done everything terrible that could possibly be done, and therefore we must attack him. The reality is he hasn't done everything terrible that could be done, and thank God for that.
We've talked about members of the administration. How do you think the media are using or misusing that phrase?
I think you're seeing the phrase weapons of mass destruction being used fairly indiscriminately in the press as well. I was very struck by an editorial that appeared in the New Republic on September 2nd that attempted to sort of boil down as much as possible the case for going to war against Saddam Hussein. And I'll quote from it. They wrote, "What is it then about the villain in Baghdad that should provoke the United States to rid the world of him? One spectacular thing. He is the only leader in the world with weapons of mass destruction who has used them. He has used them against Iranian troops and against Kurdish civilians. This is what makes Saddam Hussein so distinguished in the field of evil." Well, that's a statement that clearly confuses the notion of weapons of mass destruction.
It isn't strictly speaking accurate either, is it?
It's also not strictly speaking accurate. If you're talking about chemical and biological weapons, those were used by the United States during World War I. And if you're talking about even nuclear weapons, those were used by the United States during World War II. Now, since then, there's been a strong taboo against the use of chemical and biological weapons and a significantly stronger taboo against use of nuclear weapons. And the New Republic editorial just sort of didn't seem to grasp these realities.
What would you prefer the media do when faced with language from people like Cheney citing weapons of mass destruction? You think they should step back and correct each time?
Well, I think at the very least, the media ought not to use the phrase themselves. I think they ought to be more specific. Using a catch-all to describe all of them is less accurate, but also, I think, misleading in the sense that it does tend to equate them.
And it's calculated to give us all the willies.
Absolutely.
Tim Noah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Noah writes the daily Chatterbox column for Slate.com.
When you read a newspaper, there are certain things you take for granted. The stories in front, especially on the top of page one, are deemed by the editors to be the most important, the stories buried deep in the paper, less so. The inside pieces are newsworthy, but not urgent enough for the space and the display allotted to the pieces out front.
But there is also sometimes another critical factor in story play, often unseen to the reader. That factor is competition. News organizations put a lot of stock in getting exclusive stories, and the resulting competitive dynamics can have a dramatic impact on the news you are getting and not getting.
Consider, for instance, the Washington Post story last month about a Pentagon briefing by an outside analyst who believes that Saudi Arabia, far from being a trusted ally, is an enemy of the United States. The story got page one play not because the analyst was a major player in the debate. Actually, he's an obscure researcher with a checkered resume. Nor was the story played up because the briefing was given to the top guns at the Pentagon. The group was an advisory panel composed mainly of ex-government officials. The story was big because the briefing put into play a fundamental question of geopolitics, a question that rattled Washington and Riyadh that day and for the next 3 weeks. But the next day in the New York Times, nada. Not a word, not a breath. Nor the next day, nor the next. At the time, Post reporter Thomas Ricks predicted that his story would find its way into the Times eventually.
They're my competition, and I respect them a lot. All I would note is that in previous circumstances that I've had, the Times tends to keep its powder dry and then come back a week later as if it invented the story itself.
Sure enough, 1 week later, the Times referred to the Post scoop as part of a larger analysis of U.S.-Saudi relations. It appeared on page 7.
We're very close readers of the Washington Post.
Michael Oreskes is assistant managing editor of the New York Times.
We obviously did look at that story and made the judgment we made. Whether it was the right one or the wrong one, I guess history will be the judge.
We needn't wait for history. The ensuing diplomatic frenzy clearly shows they made the wrong decision, but hardly an unusual one. News organizations are all the time downplaying or utterly ignoring stories broken elsewhere. Last month, for instance, USA Today had a page one story about disarray in the government's air marshals program. In the Washington Post the next day, nothing. In the Times the next day, nothing. The Times deemed it page one news last month when House Majority Leader Dick Armey questioned the Bush administration's saber-rattling against Iraq. Meanwhile, the Post, according to Ombudsman Michael Gettler, either missed the story or ignored it.
New York Times had a story about it. The Post did not. That bothers me. The Post the next day caught up with it, but they put it way inside another news story so that readers of the Washington Post would really have no real idea that the leading Republican in Congress has raised questions about it. Now, was that vanity or is that just bad news judgment?
That's impossible to say, but it might have been vanity.
Journalism is a very ego-driven profession, and the truth is for a lot of journalists, if they haven't broken the story, they would rather spend their time trying to break the next story than following up what one of their competitors has done.
Scott Donatan is the editor of Advertising Age, the trade magazine I work for. Ad Age goes head-to-head not only with competing trade publications, but also with daily columns in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. When it inevitably gets scooped, it must balance its institutional ego against the absolute merits of the story. Scott Donatan.
You do have to fight the urge to devalue something that has broken in another media property first. And I think there was a time when we emphasized the exclusivity of news. And the thing there that you realize can be a mistake about that is there may be stories that really do have a much greater impact on your reader that you are giving them short shrift on.
Complicating the problem is the tendency of reporters themselves to dismiss the significance of the other guy's scoop, often by citing his or her own past reporting on the general topic, however long ago and however brief. The "we had that" syndrome, they call it. But there is also the "why didn't we have this" syndrome, in which an editor waves around the competing publication on a story that was brought up and shot down in his own news meeting the day before. That scenario itself is so familiar that journalists have been known to exploit it to spur their own organizations into action. The Times' Michael Oreskes.
This is an age-old phenomenon. You know, there's a famous story along these lines about the CBS correspondents in Vietnam who would call up their news desk and try to get stories on the air, and their desk back in New York would say, well, I don't know how interested we are in that. Let's wait and see how it develops. So they would leak it to the New York Times correspondents in Saigon, who would then put it in the newspaper. It would be on the front page of the New York Times, and immediately after the story had appeared in the New York Times, the desk at CBS News back in New York would call back to Saigon and say, we've got to have this story right away.
Thus, one paradox of journalistic competition. While some scoops result in an unaccountable silence from other news organizations, others precipitate a feeding frenzy. Slate.com columnist Mickey Kaus recalls one such from the Jimmy Carter administration when the president's brother was revealed to have a lobbying contract with Libya. Billygate, the nascent scandal, was dubbed.
It was blown all out of proportion when the Washington Post was playing catch-up to its crosstown rival, the Washington Star. The Post went into full Watergate mode and zoomed up to almost 9 stories a day. And then it turned out that it completely petered out. There was nothing there. Yet the public got the false impression that this scandal was a big deal.
Kaus says the same thing occurred in July when the Wall Street Journal broke a story about the impending departure from AOL Time Warner of AOL Chief Operating Officer Bob Pittman. The New York Times, he said, did what big papers often do when they get burned.
You throw dozens of reporters assigned to 6 or 7 different stories at it and hope that you can make up in volume what you don't have in quality. That resulted in a 3-column head when an AOL executive quit, which is normally something that's reserved for small wars between nuclear powers.
Kaus, it bears mentioning, is a relentless critic of the New York Times. Michael Gettler of The Post says it's wrong to assume that disproportionate coverage, in one direction or the other, is due to vanity. It may be due to how a story changes once it's been broken, or simply a reflection of honest differences in editorial judgment.
Newspapers, they will re-report the story, and they may decide that the story was overplayed or overstated and do relatively little about it. What you have to hope for is that news organizations keep the reader and the public in mind and don't hold back because they were beaten.
Well, of course that's what you hope for, but sometimes you have to wonder. Back during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, when ABC News broke the story about a certain blue dress and the whole journalistic world followed, the New York Times for 6 months stubbornly refused to acknowledge that anyone was even looking for such a dress.
Because we could never confirm it.
Once again, Michael Oreskes.
Well, you know what? It turns out that our competitors were right and we were wrong about that dress. I am still proud of the fact that we never said anything about the dress, and some days it makes it look like my newspaper or some other newspaper is being petulant or vain or egomaniacal for not running a story. But in that case, it wasn't that we were being vain about it. It was that we didn't have the reporting to publish the story. When you don't know something, keep your mouth shut.
So the New York Times' failure to report about the most critical piece of physical evidence in the impeachment of the President of the United States was not merely responsible, but an example of heroic self-restraint. Or about the weirdest rationalization for a gaping hole in coverage that you've ever heard.
Up next, 20 years of USA Today, what the FCC is up to, and video games with a deeper meaning.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 20 years ago this week, amid widespread hype and almost instant professional scorn, USA Today was born. The first national general interest daily newspaper with the colorful page one, nifty charts, and bite-sized stories revolutionized the way news was presented.
Readers were drawn to McPaper immediately. Advertisers, however, were not, and it took the Gannett Company more than a decade and almost $1 billion of investment to turn a profit. But it's profitable now.
As a matter of full disclosure, I myself was a USA Today columnist in the first 3 years of nerve-wracking adventure. There I got to know a mid-level editor named Karn Jurgensen. She is now the editor of USA Today, and she joins me now. Karn? Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
When USA Today first materialized, it was the subject of all sorts of just relentless criticism from people in the traditional world of newspapers. And it was called McPaper and was ridiculed for its McNuggets of information. But it's also been praised because it has had such an influence on the way at least newspapers look. The four-color photography, the full-color weather map. Does it frustrate you, lo, these many years later, that when people compliment USA Today, it's still about the color and the weather map?
Well, it isn't so much anymore. If you listen to readers, we get a tremendous amount of praise from them for the quality of the content of the newspaper. It seems to me that the people who continue to be critical of the paper are a handful of journalists and people who haven't read the paper in 10 years.
There's an ongoing debate in the newspaper business about whether newspapers should take a kind of marketing point of view and respond to the wants, needs, desires of its readers, or whether they should take a more physician's point of view and give the readers the medicine that the physicians think the readers need in the dose the physician thinks is sufficient. USA Today clearly has been a pioneer in the marketing side of that continuum.
Sure, we pay attention to what readers buy and try to give them more of that, but we do it in the context of larger decision-making about the news value of stories on any given day.
Let me tell you my beef with your paper. Apart from an occasional scoop, I can think of maybe a handful of times in 20 years that I've said to somebody else, hey, have you seen that story in USA Today? Because it was so brightly written, because the conception was so unusual. For example, when you read the Washington Post and you pick up the style section, three or four times a week, they have a story that you're practically calling your friends to say, you got to read this. And I just, that's an experience I haven't had with your paper.
Yeah, but we're not trying to be the Washington Post. We will never be a newspaper that is a writer's newspaper, if you will. We try very hard to be a reader's newspaper that's edited so that people can read the paper in 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 2 hours if they want to. Now, you know, we also don't think of ourselves anymore as just a newspaper. We have a website. We're doing daily television production. I mean, the notion of what USA Today is, in our view, is much broader than the stories that appear in the newspaper.
Well, that actually raises another question, because the publisher, Tom Curley, was recently quoted as saying, USA Today isn't a newspaper, it is a network. As editor of USA Today, who has to put a newspaper out every day, did that make you flinch or gasp?
No, I'm one of the people who helped develop the whole notion of the network. The USA Today newsroom feeds all USA Today platforms. So, for example, we have television people who are in the news meetings every day deciding what stories they're going to develop based on what's in the paper. We don't know what the future of journalism is going to hold, and we need to have a foot in as many worlds as possible.
USA Today is by orders of magnitude a better newspaper than it was when I worked there. But it seems to me that, apart from what readers may be telling you, that you just can't seem to make any headway impressing the people in the grayer daily press. Just for example, earlier in our show, we described a story that your paper broke about a disarray in the Federal Air Marshals Service that was just absolutely ignored by the other major media for the last time. Doesn't that just tick you off?
I think it ticks you off more than it ticks me off, Bob. You know, I just keep going back to readers. Readers buy the newspaper. Readers tell us they love the newspaper. They're faithful to it. That's what matters to me. We serve the public, and they like what we're doing, and they come back for more.
Karin, thanks very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Karin Jurgensen is the editor of USA Today, which this week celebrates its 20th anniversary.
This week, the FCC announced that it would not revive the rule that had long barred cable and broadcast outlets in the same market from owning each other. Earlier this year, a federal court ruled that the agency had failed to justify it. In fact, the courts have demanded that the FCC reconsider all its multiple ownership restrictions, and to that end, the commission has launched a massive review of its rules, also this week. The results could determine the future of big media, as OTM's Paul Ingalls reports.
The rules limiting multiple ownership have always been intended to promote a diversity of voices on the public airwaves and to prevent single owners from controlling too much news and entertainment programming. In recent years, some media companies have successfully appealed the restrictions, and the courts have demanded that the FCC prove the harm it says will come if restrictions were lifted.
The FCC, in some sense, is being forced by the courts to prove a negative.
Blair Levin is former chief of staff at the FCC and now a media analyst for Legg Mason Financial Services firm.
The problem for the FCC is if you look at the totality of all these decisions, it creates, shall we say, an obstacle course. And I think it actually makes it rather difficult to sustain the FCC's traditional views that we should apply something of a common sense rule here to simply prohibit transactions which we believe would result in less diversity in the media.
If the FCC is to make any ownership restrictions hold up in court, then it must be able to point to convincing data showing that the consolidation, touched off by the easing of limits in 1996, has meant less diversity, less localism, and less competition. FCC Chairman Michael Powell, on record as a skeptic of the limits, has a special task force trying to gather firm data on the effects of existing ownership limits on diversity and competition. Those studies will be publicized in a few weeks, and their data will feed the public debate. And it won't be the only data in the mix.
We've spent the last year doing an intense study of the impact of raising the ownership caps.
Jenny Toomey calls herself a rocker. She's an independent rock musician and the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, which has joined other artist, labor, recording, and retail groups to oppose the easing of the ownership caps, as well as other broadcast industry trends they say hurt artists and limit choices for listeners. They're about to release a report that includes a national random phone survey of 500 adults that shows some dissatisfaction with the state of deregulated radio.
Okay, half of the respondents, over 52%, say that radio would be more appealing to them if it offered more new music, less repetition, and more music of local bands and artists. Over 76% believe that DJs should be given more airtime for songs they think will be of interest to their audiences rather than to be required to play mostly songs of artists backed by recording companies.
Carolyn Gilbert oversees research for over 1,200 radio stations now owned by Clear Channel Communications, the company that took greatest advantage of the easing of ownership rules in 1996. She counters that her research shows that most listeners like the music they get from Clear Channel.
It's interesting also to hear people complain, well, consolidation is ruining radio. If you own too many, you can't possibly serve your community. And I'm watching just the opposite effect.
Gilbert maintains consolidation is bringing more format choices to communities compared to the days before the Telecom Act of 96, when she worked for a company that could own no more than two stations in a single market.
There was no chance we were ever going to own a nostalgia station, a station targeted at older adults. Well, in Cincinnati, we own one that does really well because we have eight here, and we can serve the niche formats because they all can't be number one. You can't make the money you need to support one radio station in a niche format, but you can if you've got a group. So it allows you to serve disparate groups in your community.
According to Andrew Schwartzman, president of the Media Access Project, a citizens' rights policy group supporting more limits on ownership, Gilbert's Cincinnati example is a rarity. And he says Clear Channel's claim of greater format diversity leaves out an important statistic.
Data from the United Church of Christ Office of Communication, filed in March of this year, showed that the number of radio stations around the country has increased far more rapidly than the number of formats available. In other words, there are fewer formats per radio station. The data just suggests that Clear Channel is wrong.
There are many other broadcast ownership rules due for review that many analysts feel the FCC will find they can no longer defend. Richard Wiley, who chaired the FCC in the 70s, now heads a law firm that represents many large media companies. And he believes the rule restricting a newspaper from owning a TV station in the same city is the first that should be retired.
Because newspapers bring the journalistic tradition, they bring the whole concept of local news and public affairs to broadcasting, and yet I find some citizen groups oppose that change. And I think that's, again, a failure to really look at the industry and its problems and try to find pragmatic solutions that will meet the mutual goals that perhaps we all favor, that is diversity and competition and strong over-the-air broadcasting.
Observers may be split about the ultimate outcome, but most agree that the FCC and Chairman Powell will find it difficult to justify to Congress dropping all the ownership caps. Public interest groups in favor of keeping the limits have garnered the support of several senators, notably Democrat Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, who has introduced a measure that includes a halt to further relaxation of the radio ownership rules. Media analyst Blair Levin doesn't think that bill will fly, but he says,
one thing that is very true about our members of Congress, the senators and congressmen all understand the importance of media for communicating and for engaging in political debate. And I think that there is a intuitive understanding that too much concentration could hurt them in their own efforts to communicate with the public.
So, says Levin, while there may be a consensus of concern among lawmakers, there isn't a consensus on how and where to draw the lines on broadcast ownership limits. After a public comment period through the fall and winter, the FCC will likely propose action on the rules in the spring of 2003. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Last spring, a St. Louis judge ruled that video games should not be protected under the First Amendment. He said they have more in common with sports or board games than they do with speech. But Clive Thompson disagrees. He's found a number of video games online, and he noted recently in Slate.com that they often convey potent, sometimes political messages. Clive, thanks for coming on.
It's nice to be here.
Could you make a distinction between the online games that we'll be discussing now and the first-person shooters and the other purchasable games that have attracted so much negative press?
Sure. Most of the games you hear about are things that you buy in the store in a box. They're about $30. They might have cost millions of dollars to produce. The games we're talking about here are little games that are designed by one person in their basement using software for web design, and they put them on a website and they let anyone play them for free. And they're usually very simple. They're not big and complex the way that one of the games that you'd buy in a store are.
Let's just take a quick technological detour. There are new technologies that seem to have made animation more accessible to everybody called Flash and Shockwave. What's been the role of those technologies?
Well, they were introduced several years ago, and what they've done is they've taken animation and turned it from something that only professionals could do in well-funded animation studios and turned it into something that almost anyone with a little bit of web savvy can do sitting at their computer for a few hundred dollars, which is what the software costs. You could actually compare it to a certain extent what's happening with online games with what the photocopier did for publishing. Suddenly you had all sorts of weird little people coming out of the closet with their strange ideas that they would photocopy into little magazines and distribute at strange bookstores or even hand out free on the street.
Let's talk about a few of these. Let's begin with New York Defender. Now, there's one that seems to be designed to make you feel helpless.
Absolutely. The way the game works is you open up the game and you're looking at a little cartoony skyline of New York. The World Trade Centers are there, and you can sort of hear in the background the sort of sound of, I guess, plane engines, some sort of whooshing. And then suddenly a plane starts flying out of the corners of the screen and heading towards a tower, and you're trying to zap them before they get to the towers. Eventually, after really only about 30 seconds or a minute, though, the planes start flying so frequently towards the towers that it's basically impossible for almost anyone to knock them all out, and they eventually hit the towers, and the towers crumble.
So the point isn't to win that game. The point is to make you feel something.
That's right. It's to sort of freak you out and make you think, to a certain extent, about the inevitability or the how hard it is to defend against surprise attacks. And that kind of interests me because clearly what the game makers realized was that the first time you play the game, you experience what New York experienced the first time through, which is that they didn't know what was going to happen, and so everything happened very quickly and there was no defense. And then you play the game a few more times and you begin to experience what the military is experiencing now, that it's possible to get some of the threats taken care of, but if they start coming too fast and frequently, you have to figure out a different strategy. You can't win that way.
And Enduring Freedom, another game, is kind of similar and yet more specific in its message.
Oh, that's right. The way that game works is you are flying a fighter pilot, a bomber jet, over Afghanistan and trying to bomb Taliban installations while not bombing supposedly peaceful Afghani villages.
Now, I played this game, and you're there in the bomber, and you can aim, and the little settlements are going by so quickly. Some have a mosque. You skip those because you know those are civilian. But a lot of them come by so fast, you don't know what you're blasting at. And the point of the game is to take out the Al-Qaeda sites, the Taliban sites, and leave the civilian sites alone. And ultimately, that's a game you can't win either.
Well, certainly, because when you're sort of rushing by, you can't necessarily tell, whoops, I thought I shot at a landing field. I actually just destroyed an innocent village. And I mean, in one sense, that sort of neatly encapsulates the whole video game nature of war. It becomes increasingly harder not to have collateral damage. And that's essentially the point of that game.
And there's another one. I'll talk about one more called War on Terrorism. I guess it's a series of games. One of them is Osama bin Laden just sitting there, broadly cartoony sketched, a pig in a poke. And there are a couple of boxing gloves. And all you do is pummel him until he dies.
Mission accomplished.
There's no way you can lose that game.
It is pretty much just a nakedly open invocation to vent your frustration.
Well, when you've got a series of games that either you can't win or you can't lose, I have to wonder whether the word game is a misnomer. It seems that these are interactive editorials or online therapy.
It's more like someone creating little visual metaphors and letting you romp around in them. They essentially take something that you might think about politically, you know, the nature of enemies, your relationship to them, and then use the physics of a game, things colliding, things bouncing, you shooting at things to make their point. It's very unusual. I don't like throwing around these words very often, but it's reasonably unprecedented in the way we communicate. I think it's sort of a new form of rhetoric.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is starting a technology journalism fellowship at MIT and Harvard. You can find his column about online games at slate.com, and you can find some links to those games on our site at onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Weisberg, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Mission accomplished.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.